And I'm going to go ahead and introduce our first panel this evening. Last summer, actually, I reached out to Dr. Glenn Fleissig, who was leading a recently formed group called the American Baseball Biomechanics Society. And really, the purpose of the note that I sent him was to find out more about the ABBS and see if there might be a fit for Saber and their group to work together. And when Dr. Fleissig and I got on the phone with one another, it became clear that our organizations had a lot in common, and really more specifically, that our organization's shared interest in research would allow us to collaborate in a lot of ways. And tonight's panel is the first of what we hope are many such collaborations. And it's my pleasure to introduce the moderator of the first ever Saber Analytics Conference Biomechanics panel, Dr. Glenn Fleissig. Dr. Fleissig is the research director of the American Sports Medicine Institute and the founding president of the aforementioned American Baseball Biomechanics Society. He is also an advisor to Major League Baseball, Little League Baseball, and USA Baseball. He earned his engineering degrees from MIT, Washington University, and UAB. Dr. Fleissig, welcome back to the conference, and I'm excited for the panel that you've brought our way.
Thanks, Scott. And I'll introduce the panel in a minute. And I want to start by sharing my screen here. Let's try this here. And that should be good. One second. So as Scott said, we're going to talk about biomechanics. And really, biomechanics, I think, is the next competitive edge in the world of research in baseball, because we have analytics, which measures the performance and the outcomes. And we have systems that measure what the ball does, but we got to measure what the person does. And that's where we're going to talk about biomechanics. As Scott said, is SABR, Saber, and ABBS, the American Baseball Biomechanics Society. And I just want to take a moment to build off what Scott just said. And ABBS, if you want to learn more, the website is baseballbiomechanics.org. Thanks to Ben for helping make that website a great amount. So on the website, we established ABBS just last year in 2020, like Scott said. The mission, if I can move this off here, is to provide valuable biomechanical data to the baseball players, the coaches, the teams, and organizations, but also to set the standards for biomechanics, because biomechanics is becoming a bigger and bigger part of baseball. We have fortunate to have 15 corporate sponsors. I just want to put the names up here. And you'll recognize a lot of these manufacturers, technology companies, as sponsors of Saber as well, because there's a natural link there. And a lot of these companies are measuring the ball or the player, but a lot of them are measuring the motion of baseball players. And that's what we're going to get into with our Biomechanics Society. In addition to having 15 corporate sponsors, we have already 200 members. And again, if you're interested in joining, go to baseballbiomechanics.org. Of the 200 members, we have four of the members here with us tonight, myself and Dr. DeWitt, Ben Hansen, and Mike McNally, Dr. McNally. And what I'm going to do now is stop sharing my screen, and I'm going to welcome Ben and Mike and John on that, they're on that order on my screen here. And I did not really introduce you very well because I'm going to turn it over to you. And Ben, I see you unmuted, so I'm putting you up first. Why don't you tell everybody, and start the panel off, tell who you are and what's biomechanics, how do you get into biomechanics and what your current job is?
Cool. Yeah, no, thanks, Glenn. And thanks to Scott and everyone at Saber for having us. But yeah, my role into biomechanics started in my undergraduate work. I was a biomedical engineering major at the Milwaukee School of Engineering, played Division III baseball as a pitcher and was just plagued with injuries. And towards the end of my undergrad, I started to learn about biomechanics and baseball. I emailed Glenn at the time and, you know, just looking for something to do in a research setting. And, you know, I'd just joined something locally in Milwaukee. He had pointed me to the Milwaukee Brewers Lab at that time, run by Dr. Jason Long. And I ended up really just being an intern volunteer there. And that's where I got my first foot in the door into baseball biomechanics. And I think timing's half of most everything in life, but Dr. Long had left the lab and they needed someone to shoot data at spring training. And because I'd been around just watching and trying to learn anything I possibly could, you know, they asked if I wanted to go down and I was like, heck yeah, I want to go down. I'd never clue what I was doing, but said I did. And so I got to learn motion capture, and that was my first step into the space, and ended up doing enrolling in graduate school at Marquette University, doing a very similar degree. And then to just try to fast forward, because I don't want to spend too much time here, but I did a research internship at ASMI after I told Glenn that, you know, I'd been working on biomechanics per his recommendation. And at that time, I met the founders of a company called Modus, and decided to leave graduate school and start trying to find a way to bring biomechanics to the masses. And, you know, at that point, still like a biomechanics lab was at the heart of what we did. We'd offer contracted services to teams in Florida, did some shoots with ASMI where we'd take the system to Arizona and shoot with teams, and eventually started making products, which was a wearable sensor called the Modus Throw, you may have heard of. And fast forward from that, was about 8 years of work at Modus, and we were going through some divestitures of the company. We sold our baseball assets to Driveline Baseball, and the rest of the IP is still moving around right now. But I'd been working some consulting with the White Sox in those last year or so, and that was kind of the next career move for me. So we worked something out with the White Sox, and now I'm running a biomechanics lab here and some software development that we can probably get into, but that's my journey. So.
Okay. Well, thanks, Ben. Why don't we go to John next and tell your journey?
Thanks, Glenn. And thanks everybody for inviting me to be on the panel. So I'm a little older, so I have a longer journey, but I won't cover the whole part. I'll just hit the highlights. So I started out as an engineer. I went to the University of Toledo, and I was doing my degrees in electrical and computer science engineering. And this was back in the late 80s. And at the time, I was also heavily into soccer. So I'm a soccer guy. I'm all sports guy, but I'm also a soccer guy. So I thought, you know, I don't know if I really want to be an engineer, because those guys just sit around and with pocket protectors in their pockets and white shirts and use slide rules and stuff. And so, no, I don't really want to do that. So I really want to be a coach. So I want to go ahead and change my major to maybe something more in the education realm, because from a soccer perspective, there's no professional leagues at that time. So it was college coaching or high school coaching. But I was strongly advised by my parents, do not do that. You are a couple years through your engineering degree. You're doing fine grade wise. Finish your degree and then find something that you could get a master's in that you might be able to translate that into coaching, because the education for the engineering perspective will always be with you. So it was at that time that I discovered biomechanics. So this is late 80s. So we're talking, you know, stick figures on real slow computers and, you know, not a lot of sophisticated measurement systems. So I started to do some research into where could I go and get a graduate degree in biomechanics. So I settled on Arizona State University. And so, Glenn, I know you and I haven't met before, but I think you've crossed paths with my mentor, Rick Heinrichs. That was a great place to go, sure, because the whole basis was on sports biomechanics. Maybe one of the few handfuls of universities that had that. And so I was able to study there, and I did my thesis work looking at a three-dimensional analysis of a soccer kick. I continued the dream of coaching. So after I finished my degree, well, actually, I finished everything but the thesis, I got a job coaching Division I soccer. So I coached Division I soccer at the University of New Mexico for 6 years, left there in the year 2000, started to try and figure out what should I do next. I hadn't finished my thesis, but I saw Rick and he said, hey, why don't you just finish your thesis up and get the master's degree out of the way? And I said, yeah, that probably makes a lot of sense. So I did that and just applied to some different jobs. But at this time, early 2000s, biomechanists were really university professors. There wasn't a lot of job market for that. But somehow, and I think they found my resume on Biomechanics Worldwide in Frames or something like that, a really old website, I was contacted by the exercise physiology lab at NASA Johnson Space Center. And they said, hey, we're looking for a biomechanist. Are you interested? And it took me less than half a second to say, yes, I'm interested. So I ended up coming to Houston and working at Johnson Space Center. So I've worked at Johnson Space Center as a, I was a contractor for a company called Wiley, and that's been merged with KBR from 2002 until last February. And my role there was to basically do biomechanical analyses of astronauts, specifically performing exercise. So in short, astronauts lose bone and muscle when they go to space, so they have to exercise. But because there's no gravity, the way that they exercise changes. And so they need it. We wanted to find out how those changes are influencing the exercise. So I've done a couple experiments up on the International Space Station, lots of experiments in what's called the Vomit Comet or the airplane that creates zero gravity. So, you know, I think I took for granted what a cool thing I was doing when I was doing it, because at the time it was kind of like, why do we have to go to zero gravity? It's a pain because everything floats away instead of this is, but you know what I'm saying? It was fun and I enjoyed it, but I was always into sports, continued coaching soccer, coached with the Houston Dynamo and Dash, and then coached, did some international coaching. Then I was introduced to someone in the front office of the Cubs about a year and a half ago, had some conversations. They said they're opening up a position. I said, okay, I'm interested in it. And I was hired in February. I went to spring training for 8 days last year in February, and then was there for one day in March before everything shut down. So it's been an interesting first year for me, but in short, that's my journey to where I am now.
Thanks, John. And before we go to the third story, I want to say people could click and give some questions. And two questions that came up already, which is basically saying, what is biomechanics or what kind of math do we use? So I just want to, I think that was just assumed, but let me just say, and I'll let the panel add to it when we get to it, but biomechanics, the word is a combination of bio, like biology, and mechanics, like physics or moving around. So essentially, biomechanics, if sports biomechanics, is the study of how athletes move around, and we have all sorts of technology equipment like I show here, but essentially the type of math we use is we use that physics stuff that you some of you liked and did not like in high school and in college, and we apply the laws of physics to how humans move, but humans are not bridges or bicycles. We have muscles and ligaments and tendons, so it's combining the laws of physics with also our knowledge of which muscles connected here and there and how much stress and force muscles can take. So in a nutshell, we'll get more into it, but biomechanics is not just the study of math, it's the study of physics and biology combined to how humans move. That's good enough, I think, for now. Mike, let's turn over to you for your story there.
Thanks, Glenn. And I'm really appreciative that you just went through that and kind of gave a little bit of a break, because there's no way that I could follow astronaut biomechanics. That's just not possible. I actually came in a little bit more on the coaching side, really wanting to go down the strength and conditioning route in undergrad, played baseball. And then as I got into my master's degree, really started to connect a little bit more with biomechanics. And so I ended up doing my master's at East Carolina University, looking a lot at gait biomechanics. But then I also got into some sports biomechanics in there as well. And also had the opportunity while I was there to go down to ASMI and work with Dr. Fleissig in the lab for a few months on some hitting research. And
I want to say, Mike, when you came down, we were doing some biomechanics research, and we particularly needed a biomechanist who was a good catcher, and you were a good catcher. So you were the right, that was your qualification besides your biomechanics.
That was good. I did take a couple of fastballs off the toes, I remember, but it worked out well. I think really my experience at ASMI kind of led me a little bit more down the research side of sports biomechanics as well. Like I said, I was really into the applied side of things, and you know, the strength and conditioning and coaching side, and going to ASMI really led me a little bit more down the research line. And I was fortunate after my time at East Carolina to be able to take a position at Ohio State, where I was really able to, get into a little bit of the best of both worlds there, where, my advisor and a lot of the people that I worked with were really engineering heavy, but I also worked with a lot of clinicians there. We worked very closely with physicians, physical therapists, athletic trainers on, you know, kind of running the gamut a little bit of running injuries, AC. We did a lot with ACL injuries, both prevention and rehabilitation. I got, you know, even got a chance to work a lot with some more clinical patients with stroke, traumatic brain injury, even infant development. So I kind of had a little bit of a different background coming up there, but then also got to spend a lot of time with some of the athletes at Ohio State and working on, you know, really trying to take what we do from the biomechanics side and put it to the sports side, where we're able to bring athletes into the lab and kind of see how they move and use that biomechanical assessment to be able to really identify, you know, how they function, if, you know, their movements are because of really a neuromechanical problem or whether it comes back to, you know, something a little bit more functional. So that's why I really kind of dove in a little bit. And then, you know, I've been with the Tampa Bay Rays since 2018. You know, it was kind of a really good organization, as far as just the people involved, you know, and a lot of the innovation that's involved there, and just kind of the message from the top down of, you know, trying to innovate and failure is okay. And, you know, we've grown a lot from the biomechanics side of things since then, as well as our whole performance science department. And I get to work with a lot of, you know, kind of really good people in integrating most of the different areas that we're going to kind of talk about, from athletic training, strength and conditioning, a lot of work with our research and development and front office as well. So that's kind of my nutshell story.
So Mike, we're going to get into what you guys do with the job. But before we leave your story, we're getting some questions, and I'm going to just read one of them. Essentially, people want to know how they could get into biomechanics. So Josh asks, thanks everyone for sharing your stories and insight. If you are not a former player, what's the easiest way to get a start in the biomechanics industry? I'm asking as a math major who didn't make it past Little League. So whoever wants to talk, how does someone get into biomechanics, in your opinion? Not your personal stories, but what should someone do if they're a student, let's say, and want to get into biomechanics and be for a major league team eventually?
I'll take it, just because I, you know, when I was at Ohio State, I did have a chance to work with a lot of students who ended up coming into biomechanics. And we had people from really all kinds of different backgrounds. And, you know, like you saw with John and Ben and Glenn, you know, biomedical engineering, biomechanical engineering. I came up from more of the exercise science. You know, I've even seen a lot of students come from math and statistics background, public health backgrounds, you know, those kinds of places. I think that what really kind of stuck with the people who ended up going on into the next is they were able to find good mentors. So, you know, being able to find good mentors in the graduate school program. And part of that is really just having an understanding of, you know, kind of what you want to look at. There's a lot of different ways to get into biomechanics, and honestly, a lot of different types of biomechanics.
Okay, Ben, let me turn to you a different question. Not what schooling should you go to, but let's say a person has a degree in biomechanics. How do you land a job, not just your personal experience, how do you land a job with an MLB team? What do you think? Teams reach out to you, or did you apply for a job? And what do you know, Ben, about how people end up in MLB, you know?
Yeah, it's tough right now because of COVID and teams being a little bit more on like an austerity period. But yeah, you'll see some posts from teams, open posts on online, like job postings for biomechanics analysts or biomechanists or sports science coordinators. That kind of stuff's out there. Getting your foot in the door, I think the best route is through internships, just something that starts at a low level. Or just through like something like more of a consulting gig, a part-time test period where you get to know a little bit about the team. The team gets to learn a little bit about you. I think it probably boils down to having, you know, public content, whether that's writing or full research or getting a chance to speak somewhere and having those things as like thought leadership. I think that goes a long way. It's tough when you see resumes from people come in that you don't know, and I think less stuff can get lost in translation. So yeah, the first step is just, I think at the lower level, how do you walk into a role that's like full time? I mean, I talked about my path, but I don't know. That was just mine. I guess we'd probably get more out of it from John and Mike there too. Like how they got their first call. I guess John was, he knew someone in the front office. Mike, would you know Joe Myers? Is that, or they were advertising for a position. I don't have a good idea.
John, how did you get, John, can you repeat, did you reach out to the Cubs or the Cubs reach out to you, or how did you get with the Cubs?
I was able to have, and this is going to link into the bigger question, through a connection, I was connected to somebody with the Cubs organization, the front office. And this was before they were trying to hire someone. It was just a get to know you conversation. And a person said, yeah, we think we're going to probably be hiring a biomechanist. And I didn't know if you had anybody in mind. And I said, yeah, me. That's also, you know, if you start to know people, they can refer you. But the bigger point I was going to make is, you know, I've got to where I am because first of all, I have lots of years behind me. But secondly, I've developed relationships with lots and lots of people. So the person who actually introduced me to the person in the Cubs was actually in professional basketball. So the point being is that if you guys want to get into biomechanics, any other readers or listeners, it's not just developing relationships with people who are in Major League Baseball. It's also with other people who are doing something similar. And that's where I was thinking also, you know, you want to get into baseball biomechanics, you know, it really doesn't matter where you work in biomechanics because force is force and torque is torque. So you can get an internship at a gate lab, right? Or you could get an internship at a high performance facility. It doesn't have to be necessarily with baseball, but as soon as you try to get the baseball job, showing that you can speak and understand the lingo and the hardware that you use is definitely a step up from this is my first job and I just want to learn. So that would be my advice.
Okay. Thanks. And I want to move on to the next topic. But I do want to say, I agree. It's a lot about connections and internship experience. And again, we're struggling for the answers to this. And this is why we created the American Baseball Biomechanics Society, because biomechanics is becoming big in baseball, but it's all fractured. And we're trying to make it a field, just like Sabre has made analytics a society and a field. We're trying to do the same with biomechanics. So again, if you're interested, join the ABBS and be plugged in that way. John, you just mentioned hardware, so I'm going to go to you first. Why don't you share? You can see in the picture behind me of my lab here, my indoor lab, all the equipment. But why don't you say from your one day of work at the Cubs before shutdown, why don't you give a feel for what kind of equipment is being used? Is it like Rapsodo or cameras? And again, whatever you want to share, what does a team use from a technology point of view? What are they collecting?
So like when you talk about Rapsodo, you're really talking about the ball, right? So that's not really biomechanics, although you would maybe use that information to then interpret some biomechanical data. But you know, the major biomechanical data that people use are motion capture data, like you have the cameras behind you, and force platforms. So we have a Kinetrack system that's in Wrigley. So we're able to collect data from pitchers and hitters live in play. And that's, as we all know, a scientist, or even if not a scientist, just maybe common sense, collecting the data where they're actually doing what they're supposed to do has a lot more validity than putting them in a lab where they may not have the same stressors or the same environmental factors. So a lot of that data that we're using are going to be stuff that's happening from in-game.
Mike, I'm going to go to you next, and then Ben. I'm going to ask Ben about IMUs in a second. But Mike, why don't you explain a little about motion capture? John just mentioned it. Talk about that. There's the marker system like I have, and then there's the markerless technologies. And talk about where those things are. And there's also video-based. So just talk about the motion capture technologies that are out there.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of the main ones that we talk about a lot are like the marker motion capture systems, which is kind of what you think of when you see the old, when you see the videos of them doing animation for video games or movies or those kinds of things, where they're putting these giant reflective dots on them. And that's gotten a lot better, gotten a lot more smooth over the years. Now the cameras are a lot better and, you know, you can get away with a lot smaller, but that's really been considered kind of the gold standard for the longest time. And you have a lot of control over the model, but there's, you know, over the past 5 to 6 years or so, we've really seen a big uptick in the marketless side of things. You know, where you're seeing some of these companies, I don't really want to get into naming names. You know, obviously we know a couple of them with, you know, Kinetrax being our sponsor and what we have in our stadium as well. But, you know, there's several companies out there that are doing kind of the marketless side of things that, you know, are really able to take the in-game footage and, you know, in some ways make it a new type of gold standard. You know, that now, like, we have the limitations that John mentioned of, you know, we're able to get actual in-game footage and over a large number of trials that, you know, it's very difficult. It takes a long time for us to get, you know, 10 to 20 trials in a market motion capture lab where we can get an entire game's worth of data and have it processed by the next morning. You know, and then we can go into, you know, the other thing that's really heavily used is the video analysis. And I know there's a lot of AI that's starting to come out now as well. That's really kind of the, you know, hot new direction of biomechanics is really being able to put a lot of that in your phone.
I want to say that John and I are a little, you know, a little gray hair a little, but biomechanics has come a long way, and the old systems were two-dimensional, meaning just moving this way, but humans move three-dimensional. So all the equipment Mike's talking about, the challenge of these computers and cameras is to collect the three-dimensional motion of a pitcher. How much is he rotating and bending? And before I turn over to Ben, I want to say we're focusing on biomechanics in professional baseball in this conversation here, but there's also a lot of biomechanics in baseball going on at universities. There are professors like Dr. Henricks that John was talking about, and in labs like my center here. So we're focusing on just Major League Baseball, but biomechanics is becoming big in baseball in the university and the research setting as well. Ben, and with that, Ben, you could talk about the IMUs, but also talk about, because its application for professional baseball, but also its ease and application for amateur baseball.
Yeah. So Glenn is saying IMUs, it's called an inertial measurement unit or a wearable sensor. And that's, I spent a lot of time developing that at MODIS. And at the time when we made it, we thought we were bringing biomechanics to the masses. We were not. We were bringing workload tracking. It ended up being workload tracking. Our first sensor could store 12 throws. And so we thought we had 12 throws of biomechanics. Our next one could store an unlimited amount. And you soon had, you know, cumulative torque on an elbow joint from every throw made, warm-ups, long toss, bullpen throws, in-game pitches. And so a lot of the IMUs out there are really used for just that, tracking workload. You know, we have a couple hundred of the MODIS sensors here we use to track pitchers. We have catapults to track player load and just how much they run around, so we can, you know, augment when we're not capturing with StatCast. We use StatCast to get, you know, coordinates of players on the field, but, you know, what they do in spring training and what they do pregame and in the training room is not tracked. So we try to, you know, fill in the gaps there. But what we don't use IMUs for is really for biomechanics too much. You know, having developed them, like, there's a lot of error in the time sync between sensors, and you'll see some vendors out there that, you know, give kinetic chain data. But just due to how much time sync error there is, you're really getting sometimes opposite feedback of what's, you know, being displayed. We often try to show how fast the pelvis will spin in the pitcher, and then when, and how much the trunk will spin, and when do those peaks occur? And they're within 70 or 80 milliseconds of each other, those peaks. And a lot of times the Bluetooth connection intervals with these networks of sensors, they're much poorer than 60 or 70 milliseconds. So I don't really look at IMUs as the biomechanics space. I still personally think the brick and mortar lab is the gold standard. You know, if we're going to really combine force plate data, motion capture data, and give like inches and degrees of feedback, and, you know, getting that one extra percent of performance out of somebody, the lab is hands down it. Yeah. That said, the markerless I think is super exciting. I mean, we use ProPlay on every pitch captured, just single 2D video from Edutronic footage. We're in a pilot with Kinetrax in our lab. And the utility of those, like Mike had mentioned, is so great. You now have, if you have a few data points that you're comfortable in data quality and validation, you now can track that every pitch in a game, every every outing they make over a season and eventually over a career. And even what StatCast has put out with Hawkeye in their base version is just, it's so awesome that that data is there to comb through. So I think there's a utility on all three of those things, whether it's an inertial sensor for workload tracking, you know, the marker list for tracking things over time. But the biomechanics lab still has such a great utility. And I mean, Glenn, how many years are you into this? You still have Mac Raptor E's behind you. I mean, like,
they're there for a reason. Yeah. So thanks, Ben. So I want to reemphasize something Ben said. The gold standard for biomechanics is still this marker system where you put little reflective markers on a person and then they pitch or bat. And the reason that's the gold standard is because that has a proven accuracy. It's not the most convenient equipment, but it's the most accurate equipment. So when we do research studies, I see a bunch of questions coming in about the fastball versus the slider and batting, and we can't really get into all those answers, but a lot of those things have been answered. And again, on our website, asmi.org, we have a lot of answers, or you could search us or contact one of us, but we're not going to get into specific questions right now. But really, a lot of the best answers are coming from the marker system. And these markerless systems and these IMU, inertial measurement units, their challenge is to make their systems as accurate as these. And that's what those companies are working on and with various degrees of success. Some are becoming very successful. I want to point out one thing, an example that Ben talked about. He talked about workload. And right now, whether it's in Little League Baseball, which I'm working with, or high school or pros, they're trying to see which pitchers are likely to get hurt. You guys are too in the analytics by how many pitches they've thrown. He threw 100 pitches. He threw 70 pitches. He had 2 days off. He threw 55 innings. That's just counting how many pitches, but maybe some pitches are more stressful than others. And so what that device that Ben was talking about, which he worked on Modus and I helped work on it as well, but that device and other things, not all throws are created equal. So just counting up the number of throws, that's better than nothing. But we're trying to add a little more science that for you in the analytics department, we're trying to make it workload, not just straight counting the number of pitches, but how much stress on those pitches added up. I want to go to the next topic. Sean writes, you think it's crucial for people who want to be scouts to look into the biomechanics of hitters and pitchers? And if so, what is the easiest way for someone to do it who doesn't know that much about a topic? And I'm going to turn over to Mike. And Mike, you do not have to answer that particular question. The question I think really comes down to you, us biomechanics eggheads, how do we communicate and interact with other people in our pro organization, whether it's the scouts or whether it's the strength coach or the pitching and batting coach? How, as biomechanists, I'm going to ask all three of you, starting with Mike, what's your day? How does it work? Who do you do it? Do you give it right to the athlete or what happens?
I think the answer that you know, maybe you might get from all of us, but kind of I default to is it depends. You know, we have some players who maybe can handle a little bit more. Sometimes they don't. A lot of times we will tend to work a little bit more closely with our coaches, with our front office staff, with our, you know, with our R&D, strength and conditioning, athletic training. Our goal for the players is that when they go between the lines, they're ready to go. We don't want them necessarily thinking about, is my arm here, is my arm there? We want to make sure that, you know, what we're identifying and what we're doing is, you know, really finding the tools that they need to go out there and perform. So, you know, when we go through and we're looking at a guy, we won't necessarily try to tell him, hey, your elbow torque is really high, or, you know, you're not using your legs enough or whatever it might be. We might try to work with the coaches or work with the strength staff so that we can then address those in a couple of different areas that are maybe, you know, not calling a ton of attention to it for the player, so that their main focus can stay on the game.
Ben and John, have your experience been the same? Are you giving biomechanics to the players or to the coaches or the scouts who or strength coaches? Who do you give your results to?
Yeah, I can jump in real quick. All of them. I've tried to become a bit more aggressive in getting the athletes involved. I think you'll find a lot of them want this data. Like, they want to sit down and they think about nothing more than how they pitch or how they move and how much they pitch. And they're already being analytical themselves. Why not be analytical with the right information? And yeah, of course, there's always a time and a place, and there's sometimes where we don't, but like, I feel it's almost my duty to give the, it is my duty to give the players their data and do it in a way that's responsible, obviously not overload them and get them to a point where they start getting the yips or thinking about their spine angle during a swing. But first and foremost, before that's done, we always meet with a member from each department. We have usually like a little powwow with the pitching coach and the strength coach and one of our physical therapists. And we just try to tell the story of, hey, we see this flaw. He really can't do this motion that we might want him to do because his mobility is poor, or his strength in one plane of motion is poor from our other tests we do. Once we've kind of nailed that down, and we've nailed down from the coaching side what they've already been working on or what their pitch usage needs to be, then we'll have a story to tell the athlete, but we give it in full transparency. And I think there's, you build trust. I think it's useful. So that's the general approach I take.
I think, thanks, Ben. I don't know if I'm throwing a curveball here. I don't know if all three people need to answer all three questions. So John, I'm giving you on the Jeopardy board here. Do you want to answer the same question or do you want the next question?
I'll do this question because I have a couple comments to add.
Go ahead.
So for me personally, I only been with the organization for about a year, and it's been a strange year. So I haven't really had a chance to do anything with players. So to be honest, I'm in a new position. I don't know if I will ever talk to players, but for sure I'm talking to coaches. I'm talking to front office staff. I'm talking to other R&D personnel, and I'm also talking to high performance staff. Though, regardless of who I'm talking to though, and Scott and Ben kind of mentioned this already, and I think it's come at a couple of the questions. I always remember when I first started doing some sports science consulting, it was with an MBA team, and the guy I was working with said, when we give our information to the head coach, you got to be able to fit it on a 3x5 card. And what he was essentially saying, they don't want a dissertation. They don't want a long explanation. They want the answer as simple as possible. And then you can go into detail if they want it. That's how I've tried to communicate everything that I communicate, is stay high level until you get pushed back on for, hey, can you go deeper into this, and then go deeper in. Otherwise you risk losing people. So that's a really important part of the communication of our information across the group.
I'm going to add, in my experience, the athlete did not go to school to do biomechanics equations and everything. So what I do is I think we use the biomechanics to calculate the right answers, but the best way to get the information to the athletes and the coaches is often the videos and also hands-on feel. But we're not showing the video and just giving our subjective opinion. We know the answers from the computer data, and then we just try to show it with video or hands-on. I want to move to the next question. We're talking about the different equipment, and Jim asks, are there any MLB rules or restrictions for in-game or on-field data collection? I know a little about that as a consultant for MLB, but you guys, what's your knowledge of experience of that, John, Mike, or Ben, about what you can and cannot collect during games or on the field?
Yeah, I jump in real quick there. So for any wearable device, it has to go through testing at UMass Lowell, and they basically just make sure that doesn't pose a health risk to the athletes or anyone on field. And then they also go through some like technical, validation to make sure, you know, it's not communicating with the player, that it can't buzz on them and all that kind of stuff. So that's for like on field, and there are some that are allowed.
But like Ben is saying, you can collect on field data, but it can't be real time feedback is what it is. It has to be a delayed. So it can't be an electronic trash can smacking thing. So you can't be collecting data on a pitcher or a batter and saying his arm angle is low or swing or don't swing or it's a curveball, but you can get data from games to be used for analyzing the athletes. Mike or John, you have any comment about what can and cannot be used in MLB? Okay, let's go to the next question. There are a lot of excellent biomechanics questions. I'm skipping most of them for the sake of the big picture focus here. But there's one great question from Andrew, which I think is important for us to mention, and we love it as biomechanists. what is the kinetic chain and what is kinetic chain data and how do we use that in biomechanics? So, John, you want to go first?
Well, no, Ben, you have the shirt on, so I think you're the one.
Yeah, yeah, Ben, you have a kinetic chain shirt on, so you have to talk.
be rude if I didn't. I think of the kinetic chain as how you build energy to move the ball or the bat as fast as possible. There's a variety of ways you can do that. So, without force plates, you can look at how fast different segments of your body spin, like how fast the hips spin, how fast the upper trunk spins in a baseball pitch, and so on. And when they start to spin fast or accelerate. And that generally helps us identify if someone's doing a movement optimally, I think. But when you combine force plate and motion capture data together, you get a whole new set of things to look at, and that's power generation. So in a swing, it's not just, you know, how fast do my hips rotate, but how much power does my back ankle generate, my back knee and my back hip, how fast does it pop through? And that's probably the more kinetic chain, because that's actually using kinetics, which are forces and motions. You'll see like the kinematic sequence is a term you'll see. And that's just more what I talked about first, which was like, how fast do things spin and when do they start spinning? But yeah, it's really just how do you get that ball or bat to move as fast as possible from an energy standpoint?
Right. And like you're saying, the word chain is in there. And it's like if you had a link, a chain, and you just did you did this, and the links would take turns going down. And that's what the human body is. I actually had a pro coach call me today and say, is trunk rotation more important than the leg motion? And I said, it's actually the kinetic chain. It's all the pieces. The most important thing for anybody is whatever their weak link is, because you need to use their whole body to be an elite athlete. Mike or John, you have anything you want to add, or we'll go to the next question?
I'll just throw in there. You guys both kind of touched on it, but didn't say it specifically. The chain implies there's some sort of transfer of energy or transfer of momentum from one segment to the next. So like if I'm going to throw a ball, even though the ball's coming out of my hand, the motion's full body, and it's typically in some sort of order. It's really hard actually not to put it in the right order. It's just, you got to become more efficient at doing it. So when we talk kinetic chain, we're really talking about everything that you two have said, but also knowing that there's a sequential motion that's happening where we're building up speed or force or whatever we're trying to do from inside of our body. When I say inside, I'm talking like the ground or our core to the outside of our body, which I'm talking about my hand or whatever I'm trying to get moving fast.
Right. You know, honestly, when you watch a video, it looks like anybody does it right. But when we break it down in slow motion, there's little mistimings. And that's what we as biomechanists could identify. I want to point out, Alan Nathan, my buddy here, says, is there a place for a physicist with no biomechanics background in ABBS? Alan, for you, there is. And I do want to say, Ben and I are on the board of ABBS. And in all seriousness, the society is not limited to biomechanists. It's limited to people who are interested or passionate about baseball biomechanics. So you don't need a biomechanics degree to join the ABBS. Mike, I'm going to turn it over to you now for the next question. There have been several questions. Essentially, when do we analyze a baseball player's biomechanics? Are we doing it to help them after they've been hurt? Are we trying to help them not get hurt? Are we trying to maximize performance? Are we doing the minor leaguers or the major leaguers? So I want all three of you to answer this. I will start with Mike. For your team, is it for the minor leaguers, the major leaguers, for the healthy guys, the injured guys? Is it for performance? Is it for injury? What do you got?
All of the above. We really kind of start coming from my background, I really do kind of start from the injury side of things. You know, if you're injured, you can't go on the field. That's the ultimate hindrance to any performance. So that's kind of where we start. But then we really do get into a lot of the performance aspects of it as well. And, you know, some of it does come down to how do we prevent injury? Okay, you know, now what can we do to maybe try and get this guy to, you know, be a little bit more efficient in his motion? We also use it to kind of monitor guys as they go. If we're working on things with them, are they actually changing? So it's our test retest modality as well. And even coming back from rehab, it gives us a good, you know, if we've got that baseline on them, we can go back and we can now see, hey, are they there? Maybe that's a good thing, maybe not, but that's, I think, where a little bit more of the, you know, art and communication comes in with some of the athletic trainer and strength and conditioning staff, you know, as well as the performance staff too, to, you know, kind of determine where that trade-off is. We know that guys who throw 100 miles an hour are at a higher risk of getting hurt. But does that mean we're not going to chase it? Heck no. You know, we're just going to try to do it in the best way, best and most efficient way possible.
Ben or John, and take this, where, how do you use it? Who do you use it with? Why?
Yeah. So right now it's only MLB camp that's going on. The minors are delayed. So we're doing biomechanics testing currently with the major league players. We'll admittedly ratchet it up a lot in minor league camp just because, timing will be better right now. Yeah. And we'll do it once a year, probably maybe twice a year during a fall camp for like the true biomechanics lab test. There's a couple cases where we've done it a few times in the same week on a guy as he makes changes and we really want to hone in on something. Like Mike alluded to, injury does play a big role in this. Like the guy coming back from rehab, if we have healthy baseline data, it's just a super valuable data point to have. But yeah, for me, like a lot of it's about how do we get that a couple extra percent of performance out of somebody, and we'll do it, you know, intermittently throughout the year.
John?
Yeah, and I'll agree with both guys, especially Mike. We're doing it, you know, you do it on whoever you can. So we do it across the org, and it's for lots of different purposes. So there could be baselining to get, you know, this is a healthy guy, so we have some comparable data if there's an injury. Could be to look at how we might tweak something for performance. It could be to just try and better understand a certain player's mechanics. So we pretty much using it for lots of all the aboves that like Mike had mentioned.
I want to point out, we've got a comment from one of my friends who's at one of the companies that makes the motion capture, one of the motion capture companies. Anyway, he points out that that the cameras are collecting data at, and pretty much delivering data in real time. And I do want to point out that the reason biomechanics is getting bigger in baseball is the new technology is really awesome. And the ability to collect data in game or in a facility like this and get, you know, when John and I, when I started this, you'd have data like a week later. We're getting data much quicker and it's accurate. And really the technology is meeting the need, and the technology is really why we're able to do some things. Let's see if there are any other questions. Again, there's some biomechanics questions. Would you guys, there's a question about, because maybe my bias, talking more about pitching, but are you guys using it more for the pitchers or the hitters or for other activities in baseball? Anybody?
Yeah, we use it for both hit. Yeah, all the above. Yeah. All the above.
Okay. Yeah, let's see. What extent? I'll get into biomechanics here. Speaker yesterday mentioned that sliders had the second most contribution towards injuries based on data of injuries and pitches thrown. Let's just comment a few, because we've done studies on this. How stressful is a fastball versus a curveball versus a changeup versus a slider? Obviously, I published a number of papers on this, but anyone else want to talk about that?
I think you, why don't you tell, go, Glenn. That's okay. A good.
Yeah. So we've studied all these questions, and fastballs, sliders, and curveballs have comparable total torque, which is like rotational force, and total force on the elbow and shoulder. Changeups have significantly less. What's a bigger factor? So pitch type is one factor, but essentially in the biomechanics lab, it looks like it's not one pitch that stands out. But what does stand out is the higher velocity within a pitcher. The higher velocity they throw, the more torque they're doing on their elbow and their shoulder. So the pitcher who throws every pitch at max effort, he is going to have a more of a workload in general than a pitcher who doesn't. And the other big difference, which is why we have jobs, is two pitchers for one of their teams could throw 90 miles per hour fastball, four seam fastball, but one could be doing it with less torque on his Tommy John ligament and less varus torque on his elbow than the other. And that has to do with the whole kinematic chain. So type of pitch is a factor, but honestly, even looking at our youth data, the amount of pitching is a much bigger indicator of who gets hurt in youth baseball than who's throwing curveballs. And it, same with the pros, it's the quality of your mechanics and the effort and how much are probably the bigger factor than what pitch type, I would say. Anyone want to add to that?
The only other thing I'll add in there too is that, you know, when we're talking about the torques and the forces, those are really kind of the overall load that's being placed on the joint. And one thing that I think has been brought up over the past couple of years a little more is, you know, actually the internal architecture of the arm, of the forearm as well, and some of the dynamic stabilizers of the elbow. And, you know, putting yourself into a more pronated position of the slider maybe sets you up a little bit more because you take away some of those restraints. But I do think there's, you know, a lot of different factors that probably there's, it's not easy to just break it down to one or two factors that are really going to predict someone's risk of injury. There's going to be a lot of things that go into it, their velocity, their efficiency, their internal architecture, how much they're using different structures of their body, those kinds of things.
Okay. Sierra asks a question about, have we looked at the stresses in softball pitching compared to baseball pitching? And I'll give a quick answer, but we had a recent symposium at what's called the International Society of Biomechanics and Sports on baseball and softball pitching. And that's posted on the baseballbiomechanics.org website now. This was about a week ago. And bottom line is softball pitching and baseball is a stressful activity like baseball pitching, but the stresses are different. And another big factor is gender, male versus female. So a lot of the injuries in baseball are probably not just because baseball pitching is stressful compared to softball pitching. If we were lived in a society where all men played fast pitch softball and all women played baseball, I'm not so sure the surgery rooms would be full of baseball players still. I think part of it is the male architecture and anatomy overloading their body. So there's a biomechanics thing, but there's also a gender thing. I do want to turn over to you guys a question. RJ asks, essentially, when you collect video data in-game, major, minor league, or biomechanics data, do teams share this with other teams, like the visiting team? Or, you know, if you collect data, does the visiting team get their data? Or is there some kind of a repository where all the data goes, or everyone's on their own? Anyone want to comment on that?
From what I know, well, StatCast is available league-wide, but that's not full high sample rate. Some teams have a souped-up version of Hawkeye, and then from what I understand with Kinetrex, is there is some sort of data share available for clients of them. But
yeah, that's what I've heard. Talking to some of the companies, Simi, for instance, each team collects their own data, but they could have an agreement with other teams. They could join in and say, we'll share our data. And so that it's an option for the teams to share their data with the other teams. Lucas says, what's the lowest level that biomechanics is done on? Is it only done at the professional and collegiate level? And the answer is absolutely not. There's a, we're just focusing on major league here, but recently we did a study about what's the difference between biomechanics of kids throwing, 13-year-olds throwing 46 feet or 54 feet or 60 feet. And so there are studies on kids just as much as adults. Well, there's more in adults, but there are studies on kids as well. Let's see. Okay, Alan asks, and I'm going to put this out there. Is there a theoretical upper limit? Oh, the question has moved. to how fast a fastball can be thrown based on things like elastic limits of tendons. So everyone's always interested in that. Ben, Mike, John, we see pitchers hit 100 miles per hour now, maybe a couple of ticks above that. Are we at the max, or if we come back in 20 years, are they going to be different based on your knowledge about biomechanics? John?
It's a hard question to answer because things like elastic limit of tendons are inside the body and they're different for different people. So the one thing that I do think is interesting is that there's a concept called conservation of momentum, right? So in this case basically says it in mechanics that momentum is conserved or it's transferred. So the one thing that I do know that anybody can do is if you take a pitcher coming down the mound and figure out how fast they're moving down the mound and multiply that by their mass, you get a momentum. Now, if you take that all that momentum and you transfer it to the ball, and the ball now weighs a fraction of what the pitcher weighs, you would throw 3,000 miles an hour. So I would say the upper limit is 3,000 miles an hour. Now, going to the one about can we actually get higher than 100, I don't know, because like I said, that has to do a lot with internal things. And that's something I think we're everyone in general, not just in Major League Baseball, but I think it's a general question that lots of people have. So from a mechanics perspective, yeah, it should be possible, but it may not be possible from a bio perspective, hence the biomechanics.
Mike and Ben, do you agree with that? Or anything to add?
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. I want to say people asked me this 20 years ago when certain pitchers were hitting 100 miles per hour, we seeing the maximum. And I think we are, because essentially people might be able to run faster or swim faster because you build up or hit the ball farther. You're building up more muscle, but what's happening is in pitching, the limits are the ligaments, like the Tommy John ligament and some tendons. And the truth is our strength and conditioning colleagues in baseball, in sports, you're really building up muscles, and ligaments and tendons don't build up as much as muscles do. So even if you build up the muscles faster, better, stronger, and you improve your mechanics, the ligaments are still the weak link. And as we know from all the players who are going on the DL, I don't see a way where the body can handle much faster velocity. So I hate to be a downer, but I think we're at the limit. And I think with that, I think we have 5 minutes left. Scott, should we do one more question, or should we end it here? How about I just give anyone, if they have any final thoughts they want to say, Ben or Mike or John, about anything in life.
I'll just say I've noticed in the Q&A there's lots of questions about just biomechanics in general. I just think it's important that everyone understands that when we talk about biomechanics, at least to me, what we're talking about is quantifying something precisely. And so everybody already kind of knows biomechanics. If you watch people move, you can see the movement. What we're doing is actually putting numbers on it so we can measure it and be more precise. So, you know, like someone asked, is biomechanics ever used in player acquisition? If you mean by collecting data on that player, not to my knowledge, I don't know, that could, or it depends on whoever you're talking to, but it's definitely used by scouts because they're watching the person and saying, hey, I like the way this guy moves or doesn't move. So I think that people should understand that the biomechanics part is also a lot about the quantification with these sophisticated tools so we can make a measurement.
John, I mean, I will say one thing, like we're here at the Sabre conference, and you guys have dealt with StatCast data for the last decade now, or however long it's been going. It's about to be infused with biomechanics data. So it's going to be a whole new, this whole industry is going to change overnight, starting this year. And you don't need to be a biomechanist to get into the data. I think it's helpful to have the understanding of the body, but I'm super excited to see what this conference is like next year after we get a season of, you know, analysis done on what happened. So.
And I do want to say on that, I want to, again, thank Scott Busch. This conference this year has some biomechanics presentations on Saturday and Sunday. We have some biomechanists who are presenting and sharing here. And again, you guys are welcome to cross over to baseballbiomechanics.org and then come to those meetings as well. But I think Ben's right. There is a natural partnership, and I'm going to turn over to my partner, Scott, on that note.
Well, Glenn, Ben, Mike, John, thank you guys so much. That was a really fun panel and a great introduction and lead in into the fact that, like Ben pointed out, we're about to see a lot more data than we ever have in this space. So that's exciting. Although on a personal note, I'm disappointed that none of you think that anyone's going to be able to throw 3,000 miles an hour at some point. But we'll wait and see. But